Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go,
I
don't go.
Titan, go.
GNC,
go.
Econ,
go.
Control,
go.
Ninth Planet Audio.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
Thank you for listening to the Turek Books podcast. I'm so excited for our guest today. He's a comedian with his own show on Hulu that he co-created and stars in, Chris Estrada. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Josh, thanks for having me, dude.
Thanks. I feel like I did a radio person voice there.
Sounded good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Chris and I go way back. We've known each other a long time, so this feels extra special to have you on. Thanks.
We've known each other, what, like almost going on 11 years now?
Yeah, yeah, I would say so. We met at an open mic at, I don't know if you remember, a comic book shop in Santa Monica.
Yeah, Heidi Ho Comics.
Heidi Ho Comics.
Santa Monica, yeah. Which I know one of the co-owners. Unfortunately, they're going to be closing down.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn.
After like 30-something years on the west side.
No kidding.
Of L.A. Like, so crazy.
And you're a comic book reader?
Yeah, I'm a comic book reader. So much so, that place has played a pivotal role in my life. I robbed that place when I was like in the third grade. Dude, this is off topic about
is
not
about
books.
Is this why they're
books.
Shutting down 30 years later?
I know.
Insurance never paid out?
Me and my friends literally pulled a heist.
No kidding.
Dog, we didn't have no guns or anything, but what we did was, it was a big ass store when it used to be on Lincoln Boulevard.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
A big ass store, and we planned it out. All the good comics, we went a day before and put them in areas that are a little more hidden. And we had my friend's mom, we measured a comic book and said, can you make pockets with these measurements on a t-shirt? And she said, what's this for? And we said, oh, it's a water balloon fight. So we have water balloons there. And then I wore one of the shirts with a big ass shirt hoodie over it. And I went in there and I put 7 comics in each.
No.
And my buddy had 7 in each. And we just
went out.
We heisted it.
No problems?
No problems.
Okay. Because when I was 15, I got caught stealing underwear from Macy's. And they took me into the basement of Macy's, handcuffed me to a fucking clothing rail.
Nothing's funnier than, loss prevention at department stores.
Oh,
those fools are cops, dog. They take themselves very seriously.
They're in Hawaiian button-downs, like very much Gary Busey in the movie Point Break.
They have sunglasses on. They're just like...
The interesting part was while I was handcuffed down there, I got to watch them watching surveillance.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very much that. Like, two private eyes on a stakeout, eating their fast food, waiting for the next kid to...
Yeah.
Stealing from big chains was a thing for me growing up, for sure. My mom worked at one, I won't say which, and she would leave her shift with a new item every day she worked.
But I'll tell you this.
So it's in my blood.
We were different from the kids today. These smash and grab kids, they got no etiquette.
No finesse.
No finesse. You know why? Because at least you and me, even though we were robbing from corporations, we knew what we were doing was ethically wrong.
That's right.
These kids are like, nah, fuck this. Like,
we weren't. We weren't like, oh, this is to rebel against the inequities of capitalism.
No.
We were just like, I want that.
I want this,
Red Bull or that ice cream sandwich.
These smash and grab kids, it's like, there's no finesse. There's no shame. I carried so much guilt. You know.
Me too.
Yeah, I carried so much guilt.
So much guilt, and that was part of the rush, though. That was part of the thrill. Was kind of hating
my
yourself.
Catholic guilt, your Jewish guilt.
That's right. Our guilt sears the world. I've been thinking about like a joke premise about because I'm a big guy.
Yeah.
And so like if I was on a smash and grab, I wouldn't even be able to find my size.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be the last one and I'd get caught.
What would be funny to imagine is you get 10 other fools, tall ass fools. Because how tall are you? You're like 6'3"?
Like, 6'4"? Yeah, 6'4".
You're 6'4". Is you and like 10 other 6'4 fools, and you go smash and grab a big and
tall
store? Tall.
That's right. And that's the thing. Like, no one wants to work with a big ass thief because he's always like, hey, and what if we hit the big and tall store next?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you keep talking about that.
You
we're
keep
all
talking
right.
about this. Yeah.
And we don't like hiding behind bushes with you because everyone can see the top of your head.
I love that.
Yeah, fuck. But yeah, stealing was a thing when I was young. But I stole the underwear and I never did it again.
I stole comic books. That was my thing when I was young.
Yeah, and you thought it through. Well, I would steal baseball cards at Target.
Yeah, all right.
Target had some great baseball cards. Yeah,
yeah,
so yeah, at least you were indulging your passion.
Oh, yeah. It was It was, yeah, I would steal comic books.
It wasn't indiscriminate.
Yeah, I would just, it was still comic books. That's what it was. First time I got a gun pointed at me was at a comic book store from a guy robbing a comic book store.
As you were thinking
As
of
I was
robbing
thinking
it yourself.
About robbing just comic books. This fool came in here. I was, dude, this was like when I was in the fourth grade. There was a guy, this older black dude in the hood in South Central, right on the border between Englewood and South Central. On West and Hyde Park, he opened the comic book store called the Comic Book Club. It was a heated-ass neighborhood. And I went there with my friend Hector Soto, and we were probably in the third grade. And every now and then I would take a comic book, or I would take a more expensive comic book and put it in a sleeve that said it was cheaper. Because the girl that worked there didn't know.
Nice.
So I would do that. And then I swear to God, we were doing that one day, and it's like, this gangster fool, like this Crip, went in there and just held it at gunpoint. We were like 10. We were on the floor. Like,
and how was that? Was it frightening?
Yeah, I mean.
Were you pissing your pants?
No, I wasn't pissing my pants. Because by that time, I had seen, like, where I grew up, I had heard, like, I'd seen shootings and stuff like that. I was just more like, oh, shit, all right, just, like, do whatever this guy says, you know.
And take the thing out of the pocket for when the cops come.
Yeah.
That. I made a video recently complaining about the prices of books at Goodwill. And then people in the comments section were like, you know, you could, like, they sell the stickers. You can print them out and bring them into Goodwill. And $1.99 on everything.
You know what kills me about this, you chiseler? It kills me that Goodwill is selling this stuff to, like, help people, don't they? You're complaining about the price.
But I don't think they're helping people.
Oh, you don't
anymore.
Think so?
No, I think they
is there a scandal behind them?
Yes.
Oh, is there?
They
I
have a Fortune
that.
500 CEO who came in from like government work and
you know what, fuck
big
those
business
fools.
So they're actively like trying to make money, whether they say they are or not. This everything between
but who
lines.
Has ever found a good book at Goodwill?
True.
I've looked in the
I always
go, anytime I'm at a Goodwill, I go, let me go see the book section. You know what I always see? Windows 95 for dummies. People got to stop giving these books away. Who's going to be like, oh, shit, I need that?
It's so true. It's like Idiot's Guide to Lawn Care, and everyone's torn up their lawns at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. There's always like a Jonathan Franzen book, too.
Yeah.
Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, and you're like, man, I guess there's a downside to being a best-selling author.
Or it's a Dean Koontz book.
Or a Dean Koontz. It's like best-selling authors get their books donated the most.
They really do, yeah.
Which, you know, that's not a bad thing to get people, other people reading it, but it's also like your book gets dumped.
Also, you know those little tree houses that people put up books? Never seen a good book in there.
No.
Never seen a good book in there.
But they're cute.
They're cute.
Everyone says that's like the sign your neighborhood's about to get gentrified.
Gentrified, yeah.
So there's one at the bottom of Santa Monica Canyon. It's basically like a book shack. And and so it's big. And once in a while, there'll be a good batch of books.
Yeah.
And my first thought is always like, oh, someone cool just died.
Oh.
And his children have to get rid of, or her children or their children, get rid of their books. And I'm like, damn, I would have liked to get to know this person just based off of the books.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't get rid of these books if you were still alive.
Or, yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
They're good
right.
ones.
Yeah.
I saw like a really classic 1970s book. It was like an open relationship, your marriage book. And I was like, damn, this thing's so like iconic and classic vintage. And I was like, I'm going to bring it home. And then I was like, yeah, but on the off chance this starts a fight, it's not worth the vintage. I'm leaving this.
Yeah. You got a favorite bookstore in the city?
Yeah, I got a lot. I think, so for me, a bookstore has to sell used books. Don't get me wrong. I love Skylight. I actually get overstimulated in Skylight because it's the lighting's really pretty.
They got that beautiful tree. That
the beautiful tree in the middle of it with the bench encircling it. And I love it there, don't get me wrong. But for me, the used books kind of mellow me out a little bit. I feel like I can afford them. I feel like they're a little worn and I could get more of them. It's like a treasure hunt a little. So for me, I think my favorite bookstore right now, it's Angel City Books, which is a tiny little hole in the wall that's been there forever in Santa Monica.
Oh, Angel City Books is great. Yes.
Okay. The guy's in there playing records.
Yes.
I'm blanking
on his name. Great bookstore. There's that bookstore on the boardwalk in Venice.
Yeah, Small World Books.
Small World Books is really,
really
good. Really, really good.
Oh, you know, you told me about a bookstore 10 years ago, and it is one of my favorites. It's just so far away, the Iliad in North Hollywood.
Yes, that's a great bookstore.
Great bookstore.
Great bookstore.
There's cats, walking around the shop.
That's a great bookstore.
But so in my mind, I think it's, I don't go there a lot, but the last bookstore just...
That's a great...
It's great.
Because they sell new and used.
They got the cheap ones upstairs. Yeah. There's something fantastical about how big it is.
It's kind of a whimsical place.
Whimsical place. Like if someone's a tourist and comes into LA, I suggest to go there. And to me... I know it's like kind of an obvious pick, but I have to go there. And then, you know, Stories in Echo Park.
Stories in Echo Park is great. There's a bookstore in downtown that's all first edition books, like old first edition books,
cool.
Like nothing over 1930 or something.
No kidding.
Yeah. I forget the name of it.
I'd love to know. I mean, and my new quest now is like I want to visit, and I'm making videos about it, of course. All 72 branches of the LA Public Library.
Oh, yeah.
And so I make these little videos about it, and that's been a really fun exploration.
Dope. Well, Central Library is so amazing.
Central Library.
So much history. It's amazing.
It's, yeah, kind of a religious experience in there.
It really is, dude. It's gorgeous.
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 Seven stories. They now have, and I didn't even see this, but a podcast studio in the basement, a 3D printer, sewing machine.
Yes, all part of like lending services from the library. That's dope, huh?
It's dope.
Yeah.
I mean, and the LAPL has picked up on the fact that I'm making these videos,
oh,
and
great.
They've reached out and been really nice. They're
dude,
like, hey, if
that's
you need
amazing.
Anything. Yeah, so I'm in the library mode right now.
Good.
The other cool part about libraries is it like sets a ticking time bomb on you. Even though there's no real penalty these days to not returning a book on time, having that date to return a book kind of kicks me in the ass
a little.
It
kicks you in the ass, makes you read quicker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But LA is full of good bookstores.
Yeah, really good ones.
Yeah, the Iliad. Yeah. That I remember being in the Iliad. They have the cats walking around, used books, great selection. Maybe the best used book selection I could think of.
One of the best, for sure.
Yeah, and... a lady behind the desk said something about not having a cell phone.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, I'm in the right place.
Yeah.
You know, these are just like real people in here.
I'm trying to think. There's just so many good books.
The guy, I was in Angel City Books, and I can't remember the guy's name. He's been there forever. Super nice guy. He's playing his Joe Cocker record, and he picks up the phone, and he's like, hello? He's like, no, I don't have the Matthew Perry memoir.
I love that.
It's like the most not Matthew Perry memoir bookstore.
That's so funny.
But now that we're into it, comic books and books, it looks like you sort of brought something like that.
I brought, you know what I was thinking? I said, I bet nobody, he's probably had a bunch of smart people in here that don't need drawings. And I said, he's getting a real idiot in here, so I'm bringing graphic novels.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So, but like, I'm just, you know, comic books were the first thing that really got me into reading.
Yeah.
So as a young kid, comic books were my thing before I really even got into books.
Yeah.
And as I got older and I phased out of like the superhero stuff, even late into high school, I was finding out about graphic novels and all these independent comic books and stories that weren't like maybe as juvenile or had more depth to them, you know?
Yeah.
They didn't have to do with superheroes. So I brought three graphic novels. I brought Today is the Last Day of the Rest of Your Life by Uli Luss. Really great one. Brought Julio's Day by Gilbert Hernandez, an epic. And then I just brought this new one that came out, Monica by Daniel Clowes.
Awesome.
Yeah. These are, I can't recommend these enough.
Yeah.
I mean, they're phenomenal.
Because for full disclaimer, I don't know this world at all,
yeah.
So I'm super excited to hear about it.
Oh, I love it, dude. I think what amazes me about graphic novels is they're truly auteurs in the sense that they remind me of filmmakers, like directors who write their own stuff. Because all these graphic novels are illustrated and written by the author.
Is that the most common thing?
That's very common in the graphic novel
really?
World. And that blows my mind.
Wow.
So what you find oftentimes in like the more mainstream comic world, and I've been out of that world for a very long time since I was a kid, but like From what I remember.
Do you get jumped by a bunch of superheroes if you want to get out of that world?
Yeah. Okay. I go to Hollywood Boulevard and I have the Spider-Man and the Batman and I have the fool whoop my ass. And I said, I'm out, guys. I found something with more depth to it.
So you get out the same way you got in.
Yeah.
Just pulling webs off of your bruises. Yeah. And
a common thing of what I find in the comic book, more mainstream Marvel DC world is that there's a writer and there's an artist. But in the more like graphic novel, independent, underground comic world, the artist is the writer. And wow. And it blows my mind. Like, it blows my mind when somebody is like, damn, I'm envious. I'm like, you can draw and you're...
It's two totally different parts of the
brain. Yeah, of the brain. And you're telling, and you're writing these stories.
I thought we only get one if we're lucky.
I know. These motherfuckers got two.
Yeah, that really is amazing. And then what, that makes it unique because what they're seeing in their mind, they're more or less putting down on page. Nothing's getting lost in translation except to whatever ability they have. But the way they see it in their mind probably is relative to their ability.
Yeah, and I brought these. And,
dang.
You know, I just think graphic novels are... I'm just so consumed by the art, but also the storytelling's always amazing. I feel like I'm connecting to this thing that excited me about reading when I first started reading when I was a kid, which was comic books.
Yeah.
You know, like your traditional Spider-Man comic books and all this stuff. But now I'm just like, I'm seeing that like... Yeah, what's cool is just you get the sense of like these things could have drawings and have comic book panels and have so much depth to them.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and that's what you find with a lot of these books. They're funny. They're heartbreaking. There's a lot of history to them.
It kind of seems like so primal almost. Like the cave wall story.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely feels that way. And it's just... I don't know. I've always been... There's something about graphic novels that I just really love, especially... Not even just graphic novels, because like some of these are collect... Like this Julio's Day is collected issues from a book that they collected those issues and made them a graphic novel.
Yeah.
But just kind of holding it as like a hardbound hardcover, it just feels like a book to me.
Yeah. And so like Julio's Day, for instance, what in there... drew you in?
Well, what I love about Julio's Day, it's by Gilbert Hernandez. And Gilbert Hernandez is him and his brother. They kind of started the American underground comic book. And there's two Mexican dudes from Oxnard.
No kidding.
Yeah, two Mexican dudes from Oxnard that were like involved in punk when they were kids the late 1970s, 1980s. They'd come to LA and get into like... go to punk shows and stuff like that.
Whoa.
And go see bands like The Germs and X and whatnot. But what was cool about them is they always loved comic books growing up. And these were guys who were reading like Archie, Dennis the Menace, old Jack Kirby books that were like maybe like superhero books.
Yeah.
But the way they got into punk, the way they contributed to punk was to make comic books and flyers. And they started doing their own DIY comic books. And they started a series called Love and Rockets. And Jaime Hernandez, two brothers, Jaime told the Loca story, which is about these two young female punk rockers in Oxnard. He gave the town a fake name, which was Hoppers,
nice.
I think. And then Gilbert Hernandez did a story called Heartbreak Soup, which was called Sopa de Pena, and in Spanish. And he didn't write it in Spanish, but it was like, but it was just cool. And Gilbert Hernandez just tells these stories. Like, this is an independent story of... it's about a dude named Julio who it's kind of like what I think of this as the Mexican version of Grapes of Wrath.
No kidding.
Yeah. It's told over 100. It tells the life of this guy, of his life in 100 years.
Whoa.
And what I love about it is this dude named Julio who grows up in like the turn of the century in agriculture, California, where it's all these like, you know, Mexican migrant workers. And he grows up, he's born in this small town. You see his life, you see him experience what World War II was like, him watching the moon, him coming of age and being this gay dude, and like not being gay but not hiding it from his family, like what his secret relationships look like. Like you see the life unfold, like his brothers, his sisters. And what's cool is that the book opens, it's really beautiful, dude, is the book opens with him
Got it signed. Amazing.
Yeah. The book opens with the void, this black void, and you see that it, the next panel, it's him crying. It's him crying, and it's him being born. And the way the book ends, it's with his mother outlives him and is holding him. And it's like, it's a masterpiece.
And she's the one who birthed him.
And she's the one that birthed him.
And like, they're in the same, she's in the same position.
She's in the same position. Yeah, and they're returning. You see this?
I just had this thought.
And what's beautiful about this last panel, in this panel, it's full with his dad, his brothers, his uncle. But at the end, it's lived 100 years and nobody's there anymore.
No one's left.
Just no one's left except his mom. And it's just this heartbreaking book, like, really beautiful book about this kid. And you kind of see America through the, you see 100 years of America through this Mexican guy who's gay and is like having a hard time accepting it. And you see like how his family grows, how family members die. And just the heartbreaking part is that his mom outlives him. And in a way, it's almost a story about the mom as much as it is a story about him.
God damn.
Yeah, dude, it's gut-wrenching, but it's gorgeous. It's, like, beautiful.
I'm already all in.
I'm excited for you to read this. I really want you to read this.
I want to.
Yeah.
I literally wrote this thought yesterday about, and it was, you know, a bit satirical, how do we cry when we enter the world because some part of us is missing the peacefulness of non-existence.
Yeah, right? That's exactly it.
And like that drawing, this was yesterday in my mind, and then you bring in that drawing and that's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah.
And I already could see what reading graphic novels is that resonance of, and did I see a family tree? He drew everyone important at the beginning of the book?
At the beginning. So there's an introduction to it.
So cool.
It lets you know. And you kind of see them age because everybody ages in the book.
That to me is everybody what breaks ages. My heart about books is, and you like a lot of Latin authors, kind of Marquez and Isabel Allende, like all their books chronicle multiple generations of a family.
And this does
and
this
that,
as well.
Like seeing the passage of time and following along to it so intimately, it always punches me in the gut because it's like you're really getting insight into what life and the passing of generations is.
And that's what these guys do. Gilbert Hernandez and his own books, his characters, he stayed with the same characters. This is an offshoot story, but he stayed with the same characters from Heartbreak Soup till now, and now they're older.
Okay.
So now the new issues that are coming out, these characters, the main characters are the kids that were kids and are the adults who were kids in the early 80s.
Right.
You know?
Right. And how old is he?
Gilbert Hernandez is in the early 60s.
Yeah, so he's writing this as he's living
And his brother, Jaime Hernandez, is doing the same thing. And I just, these guys get me really excited because they're just like two Mexican dudes, not even from LA, but from Oxnard.
Oxnard, which if you don't know, is about an hour north. It's rural, coastal, agricultural, heavily Hispanic.
Yeah.
I grew up in Camarillo for a time. So
that's
it's
right.
Just
so
one
you
town over.
Yeah, one town over.
We'd go to Oxnard, the Costco. It was called Price Club back then. It's where the best strawberries in the world are made.
Yes, they talk about that.
And picked.
Yeah.
And these farm workers are feeding the world, basically.
Yeah.
And my dad worked for the county hospital in Oxnard for the last 15, 20 years.
I love that connection.
Yeah. So significant to me.
Yeah. So it's just a really cool book. And I think what I love about it, too, about graphic novels is that sometimes, like, these guys are so talented that they tell a story in panels. Sometimes there's no dialogue and you can tell what's going on. Like to see this baby here, doesn't have to explain in written word that he's happy.
Right.
You can see it by the panel or you could see this kind of suspicious look here.
Right.
Like it tells a story through like not just word, but through like illustration, you know?
Yes.
And it's a heartbreaking book about how people in the family die, people in the family grow up. Like there's a part of the book where he's like older, this kid Julio is now older and he's gay and he's having a relationship and this dude's like, why won't you tell anyone about us? Like, you know, and it's just that, but it's of that era,
of that
you know,
era.
It's of that era of like dudes not being out and stuff like that. And it's just, yeah.
Yeah, I just read Tennessee Williams' memoir not too long ago.
Yeah.
He was an out playwright in that World War II era. And this park I walk my dog at all the time, he happened to live near it for a year. And he was like saying how during World War II, all the lights on the coast had to be turned off in case enemy planes and ships came in. They didn't want to see the targets. So he would go ride his bicycle to this park and pick up sailors.
Yeah, because those were out there hooking up.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, damn, he was having so much more fun in this park than I do every day.
That's so funny.
Yeah, but the cultural, you know, differences and shame and all these things that people
It just gets me. Well, it's just like, it's really cool. I think what I like about these dudes is that, like, just to kind of, on a surface level, sometimes people wouldn't think, but like these guys were at the forefront of independent comic books.
Yeah.
You know, of graphic novels, of stories that didn't have to do necessarily with superheroes, or a lot of the stories have like magical realism in it. They tell stories of different generations. It's just that they're kind of my guiding light when it comes to this stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that first page, it just has me, the black void.
Yeah.
And then there's a baby's mouth that's in a circle, and there's the black void in the baby's mouth, and you're just seeing a fragment of it, but it tells you what being brought into existence looks like.
Yeah, and the way that it ends,
and
that
the way
it follows
that it ends.
His life for 100 years. And you kind of see the story of how he experiences 100 years of America, 100 years of like what it's like in the beginning of being a gay dude and not being like never being fully out, and then seeing his mom kind of cradling him when he dies.
Cradling him at the end in that same image of his mouth open wide, and then the final frame is black.
Yeah.
And it's like, I guess describing that for people who aren't watching it, like that is so impactful.
Just this
glimpse you've given me. I'm just
It's great, man. I'm excited for you to read this.
Me too. Well, and you talking about punk, I think it's like a good segue to one of the books that I brought.
Yeah.
Just to stay on that thread, because you brought up the Germs. And so I brought Our Band Could Be Your Life.
Love that book.
Yeah.
Love that book, dude.
I know you're a punk fan.
Yeah.
American Underground from 1981 to 91.
Yeah, by Michael Azarad.
Yeah, Azarad. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, great book. They cover some great bands. I mean, from the Minutemen, a great chapter on the Minutemen. Like that. But it's so cool because it just kind of tells how, like, during the 1980s, all these bands independently started this own culture of, like, that later affected the 90s and the 2000s and like
and
this
the
network
grunge that came out of it, right?
Yep.
A network.
Yeah. It was all a network.
Yeah. And like, there's no rosy picture to these bands.
No.
Like, this punk scene was so, so grimy and so thankless. Like, there is no happy ending at the end of each of these band stories that they chronicle. None of them, a couple of them had big hits. Like, okay, the Minutemen, one of their songs ended up becoming the opening riff to the Jackass thing.
Yeah,
and that ended up paying for one of the deceased band members' dad's to survive in his old age.
Yeah.
So it's like that was maybe the best story. And yet one of the band members died. The lead singer.
In a car accident, D. Boone.
Yeah.
D. Boone died in a car accident. What's great about that book is that it profiles the American underground, like that like DIY independent punk. And like it profiles it through like 12 different bands. You know, they cover like Minor Threat, Fugazi, The Minutemen, you know, I think Husker Du, and like, it just shows you how hard that life was, but also how, not just how hard, but how great that network they created.
And how pure it was. In the network, like they all had the spots. They would share information.
Yeah,
this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
And they would have crash pads in each city that the bands would know were available to them. And that was like such a real artistic movement.
Yeah, that's...
Free of commercialism, because it aimed in the opposite direction.
Aimed in the opposite direction. And like, it's just such a crazy book. And all those bands are interconnected.
Right.
They all, like, in a sense, knew each other.
Shared members,
shared information. And to see that timeline right before, like, 1991, right before, it's from 81 to 91. And it's right before, it leads up to the, I think the prologue of the book is like, the explosion of like Nevermind.
Right.
Like Nirvana's Nevermind album.
Right.
And you saw how like, because I think a lot of people, when they think of like punk music, they think there was Sex Pistols and then there was nothing up until Nirvana.
Right.
In 92 and Nevermind came out. But this book tells you that American independent hardcore and punk from those like 10 years that people sometimes don't acknowledge or don't know about.
Right. Yeah. That was the brewing cauldron.
Yeah.
That was simmering on low heat and ingredients were being thrown into it.
Yeah.
And then the next half generation was like, oh wait, we could like synthesize this into something that has a bit of a broader appeal.
Yeah.
And that's what Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all those
Jam, Soundgarden. And then you kind of get that post like major. So it's cool because this is all underground. And then what ends up happening after, because of the work of all these underground bands from 91 to like maybe 2000, you have this underground that is now on major labels. And, you know, you have Nirvana, you have Soundgarden, Pearl Jam.
And then it all lets out at NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys and Britney Spears. And because that's what happens when commercialism runs away with something sincere.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it dead-ended at a certain point. Because it was never supposed to appeal to everyone.
Yes.
And it was never supposed to be sold like Coca-Cola or
whatever. It wasn't supposed to be at Target.
No, and they were supposed to be stealing from Target.
They're supposed to be stealing from Target. underwear.
Well, and I think like as a comic you can probably feel some similarities to like some of the touring you've done and just the grind of being a comedian and showing up to a place in the middle of nowhere
Showing up to the middle of nowhere, but also the community, you know,
the community.
Like getting to know people, and there's a community to it, like, you know, doing this for like, I'm headed towards 11 years, and then going on the road, and then like, you know, just going to towns. And like, what's funny is anytime I go on the road, there's always two things I look for, is a bookstore and a record store.
No kidding.
Yeah. Even if I don't buy anything, I just go, let me see if they got a good one.
Just to locate yourself.
Yeah.
Land in there.
Yeah.
There's a sense of security being in those places too.
Yeah.
It puts you back in the treasure hunt.
Yeah. Puts you back in the treasure hunt. But so much of that does kind of remind you of like being a comic, in the sense, especially those early years where you're like, you know what? I booked a few shows in San Francisco. I'm going to go up there and do shows. I booked a few independent shows in San Diego. I'm going to go down there for 4 days, and you meet the comics there and they have their own scene.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, very much. It kind of reminds me of being a comic for sure.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, I knew, I'm glad you've read this and had some insight.
Yeah.
What else do you got in this pile?
I got Monica by Daniel Klaus.
Okay.
And this is, Daniel Klaus is a graphic novelist, really famous one. Have you ever seen the movie Ghost World?
Yeah.
That's based off of his graphic novel Ghost World.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
Steve Buscemi's
in it.
Christina Ricci.
Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. Homegirl. What's Homegirl's name?
No, it's
name
not from? Christina Ricci.
But Homegirl from American Beauty. Do you remember her?
Not Anna Paquin either.
No.
I can see her in my head.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's a guy who created a comic book series. He's contemporaries with the Hernandez brothers.
Okay.
And he created an independent comic book series called 8-Ball.
Okay.
And then just a bunch of loose stories, like short stories that would come out like monthly or bi-monthly. And really blew up, like was part of that like 90s boom of independent comic books. But
Thora Birch.
Yeah.
Is that her name? Thora Birch?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's her. And he's done some amazing books. And this one is his latest one called Monica. And what got me about this book is that it's kind of 8 or 9 loose stories that interconnect about this woman, Monica, trying to figure out who her mom was.
Okay. That
she knew her mom, but was never really connected to her mom. And her mom hid so much about herself. And it's based off of Daniel Klaus, who used Monica as sort of like
a surrogate for himself
in a sense. Yeah. And so much of it is about like, but it's also like plays with the genre. Like the first story is called Foxhole. And you don't think how it connects. It's sort of playing with the old EC Comics. I don't know if you're familiar with EC Comics, but EC Comics were a bunch of these kind of horror and army stories, like war story comic books that were made in the 50s and 60s. And a lot of that was all these army guys and Marine guys coming from the war and wanting to be illustrators, wanting to be Norman Rockwell.
Whoa.
And they would go to all these art schools in New York, and they probably weren't as good. So what they ended up happening was a lot of these publishers were like, well, write war stories for us and draw them.
Cool.
And a lot of that is, but it's kind of like, this sets up a lot of it. And it's this woman trying to figure out, Monica trying to figure out her mom, Penny, and who Penny is.
Who Penny was, like, in an emotional sense? Like, she,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of in an emotional sense. Like, didn't know who her mom was. Kind of a shrouded figure in her history. Like, her mom never told her who her father was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, Daniel Klaus, when he went through the same thing too, and the way that he when his mom passed away, he said, she's never going to reveal anything to me. I'm going to have to wait till she passes. So when she passed away, he learned so much about his mom.
He went and found out,
you know, and he had a brother who died a month before his mom did, and they were never close either.
Okay.
So he had to do all this work.
Wow.
And it took him 7 years to make this graphic novel, but it's just this beautiful story about this woman, like Monica, trying to find out who her mom is.
Right.
Yeah. It's just great.
And she's piecing it together through various means.
Yeah, there's this really great story in here.
And by finding out who your mom is, you're finding out who you are.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, it's the mystery of yourself.
Yeah, it's totally that. Like, there's this story called Demonica on here where she goes back to her childhood home and finds the man she thought was her father who has died starts speaking to her through an old radio.
Okay.
And she won't leave. She doesn't leave the house, like, because she wants to just keep talking to her dad.
Yeah.
And what's so funny is the man who she thought was her father never revealed much about her, but even when she talks to him through the radio, she's hoping he'll reveal things about her. He's still the same guy.
Right.
He doesn't reveal much about himself.
Right.
But she's just comforted by talking to him.
That's nice.
It's nice, dude. It's heartbreaking. This story alone really just, like, gets to me because the radio ends up, like, not working anymore, and she can't contact her father, and that's when she knows when to leave. And she even says, like, right here, I spent the next few weeks talking to him, hoping his voice would return. I read through the last of the mystery novels, because her stepdad was a writer.
Yeah.
And then she goes, one day I asked him for a sign. I had an important question I needed to ask him. Will you be okay without me? Just then a hummingbird flew past the window. I buried the radio near an old cypress tree in the woods and locked up the house. I got in my car and headed out. Not long after, the house was bulldozed and Tommy sold land to the developers. And then it's just such a cool story of just like...
Well, you know, the hummingbird... Yeah. Did I ever tell you the hummingbird story with my dad?
Yeah, you did. I remember. Yeah.
I mean, that's why
I totally remember that.
10 minutes after my dad passed away, through the front door that I'd left open behind me in his house as he was still... in his bed, a hummingbird flew into the house.
Yeah, crazy.
And two nights earlier, my brother and sister asked him to send a sign.
Yeah.
And then through this door, my sister was like, what the fuck is that? And my brother's like, it's a hummingbird.
Yeah.
And how interesting that was used as a symbol in this book that you brought together too. Wild.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. You know what the worst part is? You turn around and then you see your sister's holding a hummingbird feeder.
Dude. So I've been seeing a bunch of owls lately everywhere I go. And I got my girlfriend this book on symbols. Yeah. And she looked up what owls mean. And it was like, well, every indigenous culture believes they're about death. And I'm like, oh, fuck. And then it got to the very end. And it was like, but the Inuits believe that they're actually spirit guides. And I was like, let's go with theirs.
Let's go with this. Yeah.
Let's go with theirs.
Don't you hate when something is like, when you stop being romantic about something because science or like.
Someone gives you the truth.
The truth. I always joke around. I always wanted to work on this as a bit, but like, or I've tried it throughout the years, but I think I'm comfortable enough where I can do it now. But I'm like, I'm going to do a bit about how, like, there's nothing worse than when you go to the doctor and you tell him that you're depressed. And then he was like, oh, it's, you need to work out. And then you go, oh, no, you don't get it. I see the world differently. And then, but you go, let me try this working out thing. And you find out you're not a poet. You just had man tits. you're just like, I guess I did need it to work out. I thought I saw the world in a different way. And I'm just fucking out of shape.
Life is a lot better with pecs, isn't it?
Oh, man.
My God.
Kills you.
Yeah. The truth is not comfortable.
No, it never is.
Yeah.
But this book, man, I can't recommend it enough. This guy, again, it goes back to this thing where he's such a great artist.
You bringing him up in that 90s movement brought the flash to me of American Splendor.
Yeah.
Isn't that it? Crumb? Is that
No,
his
that's
name?
Not. That's God, why
no,
am I
Crumb was his like friend.
Robert Crumb created his own stories. This was Harvey Pekar.
Right.
Harvey Pekar.
Yeah.
Which was interesting because Harvey Pekar is one of the few like really amazing writers who doesn't illustrate his own stuff.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Maybe Crumb illustrated for him early on. But it's just...
the connection's there because there's a really... Have you ever seen that Robert Crumb documentary?
No, I've
just
heard it's really
Crumb.
Good.
It's amazing. But that guy, the guy who directed that documentary, Terry Zigwaff?
Yeah.
Yeah. He directed...
Ghost World. That's right.
Yeah. And he also directed another movie based off of one of his comic books, Art School Confidential.
Yes.
Have you ever seen that?
I've actually never seen it, but I'm aware of it. Really?
Yeah. Really funny. So there's that connection with all that 90s stuff and underground comics. But yeah, this book is just this woman. And not all the stories sort of make sense.
Yeah.
Some of the stories, but it is really kind of a loose 9 stories of this woman trying to find out who her mom is.
Sounds
And it's like,
amazing.
People are really calling this his magnus opus.
Really?
And he even says, he goes, this is the book I've only could have done at this age.
How old is he now?
He's in his 60s.
All right.
Yeah, he's in his 60s.
There's still time. You hear
there's
that?
There's still time. Yeah. Yeah.
Magnum opus.
Yeah.
All to come.
Yeah, so it's a great one, man.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
and it's really cool that he could declare that and people could agree with it. And
oh,
it's like,
yeah.
Man, I realized some part of my existence through this thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's what he's saying. He was just like, yeah, I just feel like, he even says, I wish I could categorize it under there was a category called OA, old adult. instead of young adult novel, it's old adult novel. But it's really, man, I'm just telling you, like, there's just something to, it's like vibrant colors too. What I love is how vibrant, like, just the colors are. So much of, like, what's cool about reading graphic novels too is, like I said, it's the art.
Yeah.
It's like the way somebody can draw a feeling.
Yeah.
To draw a feeling, I mean,
the comparison between the two books you brought in, the first one, Julio's Day, is all black and white.
Black and white.
And this one's exploding with
brightness.
Brightness. But it's like a muted brightness.
It's a muted brightness. Yeah. And that's what I love about graphic novels is that aside from the story, you can take an art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and it pulls you in. And whatever gets you in, right?
Yeah.
And then, the art is telling its story too.
Yeah. So it's just really. It's really cool to see her, just look at that panel up there. It's
wow. Demonica.
Demonica.
She has green hair.
Green hair.
Green short bob cut.
Yeah.
Tears all over her face.
Yeah.
Downturned lips. Blue eyes with kind of a horror terror.
Yeah.
In
it's great. I mean, I can't recommend this enough, especially it's also this weird thing. I feel like if you feel, what I loved about reading this is if you feel like you didn't know one of your parents.
Right.
And you're still trying to discover who your parents are
to
sort of make sense of who you are. Like, this book really knocks me on my ass.
Damn.
Like, I think about my old man. I didn't really know my old man that well.
Yeah.
And he was kind of grew up with a single mom. He's kind of I knew him, but I didn't know him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I didn't know him at all. And what's so crazy is, I remember one time I was going to ask, when he was passing, I was going to ask him things about his life that he didn't want to talk about. But then I thought to myself, how fucking selfish is that? And then I go, yeah, I'm going to make you suffer more. You're already dying, and I'm going to make you bring up this horrid shit from your life so I can be like, oh, yeah, I guess that's why I'm like this way. I go, just fucking
damn.
Die with it, dude. It's all good.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you took one on the chin.
I took one on the chin.
Yeah, but also maybe you anticipated answers that weren't going to help, or I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I was just like, you know what? Why bring it up? I go, if he's the...
I think a lot of people would. Actually, it's not true, because my dad would always be like, I want to write a book, and it's like, all right, write one.
Yeah.
But it was like, it wasn't like, hey, tell me it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't, everyone has that idea of like, maybe I should make a documentary about my parents so that I have something when they leave, and it's like, but no one does it.
Yeah.
And yeah, some of those mysteries like reveal themselves through our behaviors, and some of them are actually inspiring to not know. You know, my dad was older when he had us, and there were years where we didn't talk because of divorce stuff. And my brother reminds me, he's like, dude, our dad was like in his 50s, 60s, 70s when we knew him. That means he lived a whole other life.
Yeah, whole other life.
And there's little details he'd bring up, but those details are usually the same old stories that you hear.
Yeah.
And like, man, what was in between all those stories?
So nuts. But that's what so much of this is. It's those stories of, because Daniel Klaus, he was researching who his mom was. And his mom at one point was part of a race car league, like in the 40s and 30s, and like and she was then a mechanic, and she had an affair, and he finds all these things out about her mom after she passed, and think rumors he had heard but never really been told. He was raised by his grandmother, and one thing that was crazy is he says, he goes, I never felt close to my mom, so I never even had an argument with my mom, because most people have arguments and let go, but my mom was so distant that if you had an argument with her, she would probably go, okay, then I'll never see that person again.
Right. So there was,
as opposed to like, you know, I can argue with my mom and sister all day, but I'll talk to them tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. It could, because there's that
closeness. I had that argument. I had an argument with my mom like a month ago. It killed me, dog. She called me up and she was mad at me because I got what she deemed was cheap car insurance. And she was like, you're an adult, you have a career, and you have cheap car insurance. And I was like, well, it's liability, I have an old car. And she was like, this is embarrassing, what if you get in a car accident, somebody sees you have cheap car insurance? I go, chill. But she was trying to find shit to do because she's retired. And you know what's so funny, we were getting in an argument, I said, you know, on the phone, and I said, let's hang up, because we're gonna hang up on each other, we're gonna get angry.
Damn.
And hang up. And then you know what ended up happening? After that she wouldn't talk to me for weeks. Oof. And I went to go see her, and I go, what's wrong, why are you not talking to me? And then she goes, you hung up on me. And I go, no, I didn't hang up on you. Remember I said let's hang up, because let's agree to just end this call, because why get angry and hang up on each other?
Yeah, why not? Let's
and
not
then
hang up
she,
on each other.
She said, nope, I don't remember it that way. You hung up on me. And then you know what I said? I said, you know what? You're right. I did hang up on you, and I'm sorry.
Yep.
And I said, I'm sorry I did that. And then she goes, I'm your mom, I deserve respect. I go, I don't deserve you. And then I was like, I don't deserve you. I was like, I hung up on you, I'm so sorry. And then she goes, you should be. And I said, wow. What am I going to argue with this old woman? I mean, I love her, you know? I said, let her have it.
And the magic words.
You
said the magic words. You know the script. You were raised by her.
Yeah.
You were raised by a single mom. There's a script there.
Let her have it.
And it's, you're right.
You're right. Yeah.
You let some time pass.
Yeah.
Yeah, one or the other.
Yeah.
But you just want things to be okay.
Yeah, I just want things to be okay.
You just want things to be settled.
Yeah, so that's what I love about this book.
Did you end up getting better car insurance?
No, I still got the same car insurance.
Okay.
I'm not going to get full coverage, dog. My car is 11 years old. Yeah.
Yeah, you're pretty. Yeah. Yeah. Once the car. Yeah. No, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I love it, Chris.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Okay. So, I mean, you got a third and final. I feel like you've already converted me into graphic novels. Now I'm going to have some other obsession.
Yeah. This is a good one, man. This is Uli Lass. She's from Austria. I mean, just look at this cover. How amazing is that
cover?
Today
is the last day of the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And it's red, line drawn,
white lettering. It's just gorgeous. But anyways, Uli Lass, she's from Austria. She's a cartoonist. These are all on the same publishing company, Fanagraphics, some of the best American publishing of independent comic books. But she, this woman's name's Uli Lass, and she wrote a memoir about her life when she was a kid, and she was a young punk rock kid hitchhiking from Austria to Italy, to Sicily.
Oh man.
So it's just a great book about it's set in 1984, her and her friend go on this journey of just hitchhiking and meeting other punk rockers and feeling like posers, but sometimes feeling like they're authentic, getting in trouble with the cops, falling in love with dudes on the way, getting their hearts broken, writing letters back to their friend. And it's just it's such a pure book. It's such a pure book of just being a try hard kid and trying to figure it out, you know?
youthful adventures.
Yeah, and it's like, and it's also something that like seems so European to me, this idea of hitchhiking.
Right.
You know, you out here, you think hitchhiking, you think fools are going to kill you, you know? Not that there ain't murderers out in Europe, but, you know, there's just something. Maybe I'm waxing poetic about a culture I don't know, but I'm like, it seems like they probably did a lot more hitchhiking, or it was a lot more, not as scary, maybe. Or,
not as scary. Yeah. Well, and I think in that era, it was a little more common.
Yeah.
Like, I think even in the States, there was some hitchhiking going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm trying to think of it. I've hitchhiked small distances in my.
Have you?
Yeah,
small distances. Dude, this is perfect. You hitchhike small distances.
I'm talking small, you know, as a teenager, or I think once in Big Sur, my brother and I parked way too far from where we were going, and we were like halfway there. And so we hitchhiked with this Japanese tourist in a red Mustang.
Crazy.
Yeah, you know, but like it is not an adventure to write about, but just the idea of sticking your thumb out and getting a ride is pretty cool.
Well, what's so crazy is I remember one time me and my girlfriend, we went to Scotland and we were in the Isle of Skye and we saw these two young women hitchhiking, and my lady was like, pull over, and I said, yeah, let's give them a ride. And then we were talking to them, they spoke English, and we were in the Isle of Skye, like northern Scotland, really gorgeous
up there.
Beautiful
up there, huh?
Beautiful. And they were like, you guys are from America? And we were like, yeah, you're hitchhiking? Yeah, we're just hitchhiking to this one place, and then we're going to rent a car. She goes, oh, we'd love to, do you think we can do this in America? And I got into dad mode. I go, don't you ever fucking do this in America. I go, you're lucky I'm a good guy. Well, we're patting myself on the back. But I'm like, no, don't. I go,
this dream that you're living in right now, it dies at our border.
Yeah, it dies.
I go, it's true.
Yeah.
Distrust is in the air in this country.
Yeah, but there's something so crazy about this book is all about hitchhiking.
Yeah.
And she tells it through these like really gorgeous, like her style of drawing is so cool. It's like line drawing. It's mostly black and white, but she adds some color.
Yeah, it just looks like an expression of a person. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, hey, this is who I, this is.
It looks like an expression of a person. It's like, there's technique there, but it doesn't look like collegiate technique.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, and so it's just like gorgeous to me. Like
I love that confidence of someone who's like, hey, this is how I've always drawn, and this is how I'm going to keep drawing.
Yeah.
Because this is how I see the world and how I draw.
Yeah.
And usually that comes through in a pretty genuine
she's great
way.
But the whole thing is just hitchhiking and two friends. It's like these two like 15-year-old girls.
Amazing.
And then they go from being the best of friends to not being friends by the end of the trip. And they both have these relationships with different people. They both backstab each other. But it's so much of what, like, being a kid. You know when you're 15 and 16 and everything feels, any slight betrayal feels like the end of the world?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that's what this book is to me.
You're reminding me, my mom was born and raised here. And she lived in a house on, like, Fairfax and Melrose. And when she has a story of when she was 6 years old, she got on the bus without telling her parents and rode to the La Brea Tar Pits by herself.
Crazy.
Yeah, and just like that's,
I love that.
That's in the early 60s LA. Can you imagine seeing a six-year-old on the bus by themselves now?
I know, I can't even
imagine. The SWAT teams that would come and the, you know, and just like the horror you'd feel seeing that. Yeah, I don't know that it was much safer. It was just maybe more lax. You said you went into dad mode, and it's like, I don't think that kind of mode was enforced as often back then.
Yeah, people are probably like, not my kid.
Yeah, well, we have so many media news horror stories now.
I know, right?
And that's what sells clicks, and so we hear about it constantly.
These are the kind of books that I recommend to people who are heavy readers.
Right.
Like, who like weighty literature.
Yes.
I go these would be like three graphic novels that are go get into these, and you could see like what the medium does.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in. Like, I'm not here to be persuaded of anything. Yeah, yeah. It's just listening to you talk about these and getting glimpses into them. It's like, oh man, this.
Oh yeah.
It's a whole other fun world.
Yeah, it's a crazy world to see, and there's so much to take in. Like, you know what's so crazy? And in some ways, you would think they're easier to read because they have drawings, but that they actually take me longer to read
right
than a regular book
right
because I'm I'm not only reading the words, I'm taking in the panels. Right. I'm taking in the illustration. I'm like looking at it longer. I'm looking at a page longer and taking it in more.
That makes sense. I could see where that would bother some readers.
Yes, I could see that too.
There was just this in this Chris Hedges book I wrote. He read, I didn't write it, I wish.
Oh, I love Chris Hedges.
He was talking about gambling.
Yeah.
And in casinos, these people sitting at the slot machines.
Oh, was that the America book?
Yeah, Farewell Tour.
The Farewell Tour. Yes, dude.
Okay, so
that's if people get a chance, YouTube, look up Chris Hedges on YouTube, see some of his talks. Like, yeah. It's a really phenomenal, great contemporary nonfiction.
Moral rot.
Yeah.
Of our day and age. Well, he was talking, so you probably remember the gamblers, they're pushing the
at
slot
the Trump
machines.
Casino.
At the Trump Casino as it's being gutted and sold to venture capital, whatever. But these people at the slot machines would actually get upset when they won.
Yeah.
Because it would disrupt their rhythm.
Yeah.
They just wanted to keep pushing the button and staring at the lights.
Yeah.
And zoning out and smoking cigarettes and
isn't
drinking.
That crazy?
Yeah. And like I could see how
their day is done.
Their day is done.
If they won, they have to now get up. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so like they want to be numbed out. They don't want to win.
Yeah.
And so sometimes as a reader, you know, you could see wanting to stay in that state too. But I to me, this looks so fun.
Oh, dude, yeah,
and
it's
I think
great,
you've
man.
Like opened up a whole new channel of potential interest.
Yeah, especially for your listeners. If they've always thought of comics as a kind of juvenile thing, man, this world of like independent underground comics and graphic novels really... Yeah,
it also makes me think, like hearing your story, we should let children steal 5 books a year.
Yeah.
Because they're going to grow up to buy so many more books in those genres that they figured out that they love.
Yeah, yeah.
And ultimately, the book industry will benefit.
It benefits from a little thieving every now and then.
Well, I actually, you brought up Small World Books in Venice.
Yeah.
I was in there a couple months ago. I haven't finished this book. It's called Yesterday by Juan Imar. He's Argentinian. Chilean. And
yeah, I've heard of this dude. Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yeah. But what sold me on the book, it was in the staff recommendation center. And the person who worked there wrote, "This is the only book I've ever read where a married couple likes one another."
Yo,
and
crazy.
I got to buy it. So I'm reading it so far. It's great. It's,
you're liking it?
Yeah, it's avant-garde surrealism.
And it's a novella too, so it's short. Like
short.
It's digestible.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, super digestible book.
You kind of need to that digestibility sometimes just for your own reading confidence.
Yeah, I think sometimes you can't read. I think sometimes people who want to read will get consumed with thinking of reading these big classics.
Yes.
Like, I'm going to read War and Peace. Yes. I'm going to read Grapes of Wrath. Nah, my boy, train yourself. Start with the short stuff first. Like, ain't no shame in that, you know?
That's right.
Read yourself on a 100-page novella.
I'm in that camp. There's some camps that are like, challenge yourself and you'll discover something. But for me, it's like, hey, whatever, like, is it a summer read that you could read, you know, get through in a couple sittings next to the swimming pool? Do that.
Yep.
Because like that enjoyment is gonna benefit you more than the suffering that comes with...
We were talking about John Fante before we started recording, and he's someone that his reading is so light and easy to... I mean, it has a lot of depth to it.
Right.
But it's so, like, digestible.
Yes.
And they're short novellas, and, like, man, it's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Someone was saying, like, I saw it on a podcast, that, like, the reason the military makes their bed in the morning first thing is because it's task completion.
Yeah.
And that gives them a confidence that if you complete this task, you can complete more.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. And so sort of similarly with books, right?
Yeah.
John Fante is a great example. His books, you breeze right through them, but you don't feel like they're breezy.
Yeah.
And then that brings me to a real slow read that
I
love every page of it, but it took me 6 months off and on to finish. An L.A. classic, City of Quartz.
Yeah, R.I.P. Mike Davis.
R.I.P. Mike Davis. And that's actually what brought him to my attention, was his death a few years ago.
Yeah.
He's
a Chris Hedges type of dude to me.
He is. Chris Hedges even quotes him, I think, in America, the Farewell Tour.
Very, I would say, a working class writer.
Anti-establishment.
Anti-establishment, pro-union. Was a truck driver at one point. I don't know if you knew this.
Yes.
But he was a truck driver. And, you know, comes from a real hardened background of, like, being part of the working class. And here's just history on Los Angeles and like that Los Angeles that was like post the LA riots.
Yeah.
And making sense of that and making sense of the history of the city, the different demographics.
The like, power structures.
The power structures.
The corruption.
The corruption, yeah.
You're L.A. born and raised, so yep. I feel like this is like
oh, I love that book,
one
dude.
Of these essentials.
I love that book. And even if you're not from L.A., what's great about reading that book is that it'll make it shows you how it demystifies L.A. Because
yes.
you think of L.A. as this, like, if you're not from it, you kind of think of it as Hollywood land.
Yes.
You know? But you see how, like, working class, how gritty, how the politicians don't care about the city.
Yes.
And it's always up for sale.
Always.
The city is always up for sale.
Like, in this, he's talking about the Japanese, and so it's the late 80s, how they're buying up all the buildings. And now, you know, then we're 25 years later, China came, Koreans
You have a lot
came.
Of these ghost buildings.
Right?
Yeah, these ghost condominiums.
That started like, and weren't finished or weren't that finished. The plans yeah. weren't realized. He also talks about how, like, you're talking about demystifying L.A. as Hollywood land. He talks about how L.A. projects this liberal image, but its roots in what we know of modern L.A. were very hardcore, almost, yeah, they were white supremacists
yeah,
in
a way.
Yeah,
with the cops.
The
with
cops. The redlining.
The redlining.
The, where the freeways were built
yeah.
as a means of segregation.
Yeah.
He also talks about how then in the 70s, we started projecting this Hollywood liberal image while most of our working class were immigrants who couldn't vote.
Yes.
So it's like, yeah, you can project this sort of soft liberal idealism while
yeah.
still being what he calls the ultra capitalist experiment in the
oh,
world.
Oh, yeah, big time.
And that's what LA is.
Yeah.
At this point. Like, it was a place for developers to run rampant and the politicians who enabled them.
Yeah.
And now, it's just so funny the ideas we have about LA. I've been here pretty much my whole life
yeah.
or out in the suburbs of it.
Yeah.
And, but what it really is totally different.
That book just makes you want to drive around the city, get on the bus, get on the train.
Yes.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, there's something about that book and the history, like the way he breaks things down, like the riots and the participation of different groups. I mean, he even breaks it down to the niche of like Cambodians and their history in Long Beach.
Yes.
Like, fascinating.
Fascinating.
You know?
I think he released it right before the riots, but he basically found this book because they say he predicted it.
Yes.
And he's like, anyone who had their ear to the ground knew it was coming.
Yes.
He goes,
yeah.
but the media and everyone else wouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Or wouldn't have foretold it because they didn't have their ear to the ground or they were protecting the people who
yeah.
were getting rioted against.
Yeah. They didn't understand the tensions between kind of Korean store owners and the black community.
Well, and the police state encircling the
yeah,
black community.
The difference between affluent Latinos and working class Latinos. One thing he breaks down is like this, like how like the working class Latinos being Mexicans and Central Americans and the more affluent Latinos whose businesses got rioted by working class Latinos were like affluent Cuban immigrants.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, just like it's a great book, man. I just, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great book, and it just puts into context a lot of the world that we're living in today, but it doesn't go down slow. It's weird. I've never read a book that I love each page I read, but each page is exhausting.
It's an exhausting book, yeah. It's not like, I would say it's a book that sometimes I feel like a good advice to give people, and not that I'm the most voracious reader or I'm reading tons of books, but don't be mad at yourself for not finishing it in a week.
Right.
Not finish it. Like, with a book that weighty, give yourself time, man. It's like a journey, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if it takes you 5 months to finish it, that's not a bad thing.
That
just makes you go, like, you're sitting down and taking time and digesting it.
Yeah,
you know?
You're living with it longer.
Yeah,
and if there's a lot to live with.
That's a book you live with. I mean, that's a book. It took me, I think I'm the same way. Like, I read it. It might maybe took me, like, 4 or 5 months or something,
yeah.
you know?
Small bites. You talking about it makes you want to ride the buses or drive around L.A. gave me this flash of an old joke you had. I don't know if you still do it. I mean, it was something about how your girlfriend broke up with you and it made you want to drive around L.A. at night to solve the Black Dahlia murders.
Oh, yeah. I used to have this joke that I did that I go, One time I went through this breakup where I was so heartbroken that I preoccupied my time by trying to solve the Black Dahlia murder. Where it was just like, I haven't done it in years, but the idea was that, like, this goes back to, I got consumed with the Black Dahlia murder, one, because of a breakup, and two, around the breakup, I was reading about the Black Dahlia. I read James Ellroy's book on the Black Dahlia. I read a book, a nonfiction book that James Ellroy wrote about his life, and his mom was murdered by someone who they assumed might have also murdered the Black Dahlia.
No way.
It turned out not to be the case.
Okay.
But at one point was suspected to have been murdered by the same person. And I got into LA history and I was so heartbroken at the fucking time. And I just, you know, when you go, you're not dealing with your demons.
Oh, yeah.
You're not dealing with the thing. So you're mad about something else. And then I was just like, dude, I was so mad that the LAPD didn't never solve this case that I said, I'm going to fucking solve this case. A 25-year-old shithead. And then I was like, literally, dog, I was driving around at night. Like I'm some idiot detective. I go, where did she go from here?
Weren't you like also doing Postmates at the same
time? Yeah, dog. I was like delivering food at the same time, thinking that I was going to solve a case.
Peeking into customers' doors.
It lasted a week.
That's so
my
funny.
Obsession with this. And you know what broke my obsession? Was my ex texting me going, hey, we should hang out. Just tells you how not invested I was. Dog, I'll never forget this. I was delivering food at the time and I was in downtown and one of the last places that Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short is her name. One of the last places she was seen alive was the Biltmore Hotel in downtown.
Yeah.
Over right across the street from the park. I forget what's the name of that park. Anyways, but she was seen there. I went there and I was like an idiot. I was just standing there. I go, where did she go from here?
Light up your cigarette and walk away.
Light up a cigarette. Somebody comes up, sir, you can't smoke in here.
That's so funny.
I go, you don't get it. I'm trying to solve a case.
That's so funny. Yeah, when Amy Silverberg was on here, she was bringing up how so many of the iconic LA writers are so dark. And that whole noir, the Elroys, the Chandlers.
Chandlers, yep.
And all that does make you think like, yeah, you needed this counter to the sunshine. And just to the sunshine, you know, that so much does loom in the shadows, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is interesting how most of the iconic LA writers, it is about the dark.
Yeah.
Even as tourists flock here every
day. I think about LA books, like I remember one book that's so dark that I never got into was Less Than Zero.
Dude.
Bret Easton Ellis
18
book?
Years old. I moved to Hollywood.
I remember we talked about
next
this.
Next to the freeway, sharing a one bedroom with my sister. Beneath us is a woman smoking crack, losing her mind, who I walked past in the hallway after hearing her yell at herself for weeks, and she looked like a Victoria's Secret model.
Yeah.
And the first book I read in the living room I'm sleeping in was Less Than Zero, which could not have picked a worse book.
It's so nihilistic.
It made me feel horrible about the city I was living in.
Yeah.
The rich kids running around.
Running around.
Doing God knows what.
Yeah. At first I was like, this guy's kind of soulless. But now as I got older, I realized, oh no, he was telling a story about soulless people,
He just was so good at speaking their language.
Because he was one of them.
Right. At least ran with them, right?
Ran with them, yeah.
And that one book kind of was like, I'm good on the Bret Easton Ellis
for
a lifetime.
Yeah, same. Dude. It was the same way. It's crazy when books get you kind of angry.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I had that feeling when I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Because this fool, dog, it was the most romantic bullshit I'd ever read. Where I said, come on, dog, you're not even being reasonable. At one point in the book, you know, it's this guy, he's in the 1950s, he's discovering America, going hitchhiking.
Wheeling around,
him and his friend, Neil
Ginsberg or
no Moradi who was based off of Neil Cassidy,
right? Cassidy,
yeah. But at one point in this book he meets this Mexican woman in Northern California and she's a farm worker and she's poor and she goes back to his to meet her family and they live in a farm like indentured servants and he sees the romance in it. He goes and he's just like, and I'm just like, dog, are you serious? And then he goes to Denver towards the end of the book And he looks at this older black dude in this black part of town. And he goes, and at that point, I remember thinking to myself, I would wish I was an older black man. Oh, I go, damn. In the 1950s? Come on, dog. You're an idiot. The romantic idiot.
The white but, tourism.
Yeah, it was a lot of that. But what's so funny is it's a book that I got on my nerves, but I see how good of a writer he is.
Yeah?
Yeah, but it got on my nerves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, early Instagram was just plagued by people putting up little quotes of his.
Yeah.
And to me, yeah, I think he just has, like, a sexy name and a sexy idea behind him. I do know he was a good writer. I read On the Road. I read Dharma Bums.
Dharma Bums is a good book. Yeah,
it was a good book, and certain ideas stuck with me. But, yeah, I think one of those definite overrated. And also, it was, like, the real story, evidently, was, like, he was having sex with those guys.
Yeah.
And how cool of a story would that have, like, had he really gone there, right? Yeah. It's like, you were in love, the romances between the guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And each other.
Just be some gay fool and tell us about that.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're waxing poetic about this poor Mexican woman and her farm worker family. You want to be here. They don't want to be here.
Yeah, that's right. Trade spots.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, this was an amazing conversation.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We go way back, and you've just always been a great guy.
Oh, yeah. We always chop it up about books.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've taken little mini road trips together and just always chop it up, and I really appreciate you coming in. This was so inspiring to me.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I'm glad to be the first person to bring graphic novels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. Only one I've read recently, a friend sent me, and it was about a John, like, who hires prostitutes.
Oh, Chester Brown?
Yeah, Chester Brown.
That's a great book.
It was.
That's a great book. Chester Brown, a great Canadian cartoonist.
Yeah, and very, like, matter-of-fact about his lifestyle. Very.
It's called Paying for It.
That's right, Paying for It.
Yep.
Yeah, and so it's nice to get exposed to more of the realm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think these three are good.
All right.
Cool.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.